Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Not hearing me. Hi, I have unmuted Dee McLean. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, perfect. I just wanted to make sure. I'm going to mute you again until we get started.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. This is Lisa Pompa, and I was I'm hosting the call, and I see that we've hit 1 o'clock. I have unmuted everyone because this is the first one that I've done, so I don't know, Pat, if you're on the call or if somebody else is leading the call, if you want to get started.
Yes, hi, this is Jan Carson. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you.
We're so happy to have you with us. And I'm not sure if Pat's on the call. So we can go ahead and get started. I think Pat records who is on the call, so we'll skip that part. But I just want you to know that there's representatives from all across the country, from Alaska to Florida and every place in between, for behavioral, primarily behavioral health care. And we're very interested to hear your presentation. So thanks very much.
You're welcome. So should I just go ahead and get started? And when I am done, yes. I'll hand it over to y'all, okay?
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you.
Okay. I'm probably going to go ahead, just for feedback or whatnot, I'm going to go ahead and mute everybody again, if that's all right. And then I will probably open it up a couple times to see if anyone has any questions. And then again at the end for everybody. Or I can keep it open. It's up to y'all.
Well, everyone can mute their lines, right? We can.
Yes, you all can mute your own lines if you would like.
Star 6, I think it is. Is that right?
I don't know exactly.
Yeah, I think it's star 6.
Yeah, and that's what the system indicated. Plus, many of us have mute buttons on our phones on the hardware anyway.
Right. If you're on a cell phone, you can use your mute button or your office phone. Whatever works, star 6 or the mute button. All right, very good.
Okay.
Thanks, Steve.
I am going to go ahead and get started then, okay? I'm not quite sure how long I had, so I'm going to go through this, and if you all have questions, please let me know. But here we go. So I was asked to talk originally about our girls' groups, and I asked instead if I could do, involving our girls' groups, but do a presentation on the outcome measures that we've collected over a 3-year study with treating survivors of sexual exploitation at our largest campus program here in the state of Florida. Which is our Vieira campus. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of background, just so we're all on the same page. I know we probably all know what CSEC is, but I do like to give just a little bit of a blurb that what we talk about when we're talking about the commercial sexual exploitation of children is any sexual activity involving a child or a youth in exchange for something of value or promise thereof to the child or another person or persons. The child's a commercial and sexual object, and it is a form of violence against kids. Some of the statistics that you see, there's all sorts of statistics out there, but we like to use this one, which is just that there are a lot of sex trafficking cases across the United States. There are labor trafficking, and the top 10 child trafficking industries, as reported by the Polaris Project, were pimp-controlled prostitution, peddling rings, pornography. What we see a lot in the state of Florida and what we have treated a lot of is the pimp-controlled prostitution as well as gang-based prostitution. Some other statistics, 9% of 1,601 youth surveyed reported to have engaged in survival sex. Survival sex is something that our young people, especially the young people that we treat in residential treatment facilities, who often come from very dysfunctional backgrounds, maybe some foster care backgrounds as well, have a high prevalence as participating in survival sex, meaning that they're participating in some sort of sexual activity for clothes, shelter, food, whatever it means to survive on the street. A New York City provider of services to homeless youth found that 1 in 4 had been a victim of sex trafficking, and 48% engaged commercial sex because they didn't have a safe place to stay, which is especially, it's provocative as well as thought-provoking to us in that the type of education and prevention services, if your agencies also do that, who we need to target, right, are dysfunctional runaway youth at homeless shelters, etc. I was just talking with someone else in the state of California, and they are, through their TA project, doing a survey on transition age youth, which are ages 18 to 21, and in a survey of, I want to say it was about 1,800, it hasn't been published yet, about 1,800 youth, and they asked equal amounts males and females that has aged out of the foster care system in the state of California, did you ever have to participate in survival sex? The percentages that they were talking about in their study were reaching over 60%, and it was the same for both males and females, which is enlightening in that what the youth have to participate in. Or what they feel that they have to participate in. I like to give a little shout out to Shares Hope's website. I don't know if anyone's interested with or knows anything about Shared Hope, but a lot of what we talk about in Florida and why we were able to really get some kind of actionable movement in our treatment of child sex trafficking victims was our state laws. So that the state really invested some time, energy, and money into forming services for those that have been victimized. Shared Hope started in, well, it started a long time ago, but they started in 2011 issuing these report cards for each state. And if you go to this website, and I can share this with folks afterwards, different websites that I might reference here, that's no problem. I can send that out. But what they measure states on are six different things. And the six different things are the criminal penalties for purchasers, for traffickers, as well as for those that are purchasing sex, the decriminalization of youth prostitution in the state, the ability to prosecute in the state laws with the ability to prosecute, and then access to services for youth victims of exploitation. And if you look at this map, they go from 2011 to 2016, and they give each state a grade. And I know we have everybody from around the nation on the call, but we were really, in 2011, we were hitting a C, and last year we finally got an A, and a lot of that had to do with the advocacy and the support that we were able to get in the state of Florida. It's really important that if you're thinking about treating you survivors of sex exploitation, that you know what your state laws are and that the state is supporting the treatment. It proves to be... not only access to services is easier, but the money behind funding services is there as well, which has really been our ability to provide some pretty stellar services to youth that have been victims of trafficking. Our most recent one is what I really, really am proud of, is that Florida House Bill 5845. We cannot, if you're a youth, you no longer are able to be prosecuted for any sort of human trafficking offense, which is just, you know, they decriminalized it in 2014 with the Safe Harbor Act, or 2013 with the Safe Harbor Act, but now you just can't. It removes minors absolutely from that process, so they will not be prosecuted for any offenses related to human trafficking. A little bit about Devereaux. I know I saw some other Devereaux people on the little participants list when we were... going or when we were starting. I am going to mute somebody here because I'm getting some feedback from this one. So what Devereaux, Florida does do is we are able to have a long history in the state of Florida. And of course, Devereaux is a nationwide organization. But here in the state of Florida, several years ago, we said, the state actually came to us and said, would you please develop programming for survivors of exploitation? And we said, okay. At that point in time, we already provided all of these services that you see, everywhere from prevention to our intensive residential treatment centers, which is what we're going to talk about today, is the programming at our intensive residential treatment center. And we call that our Delta programming. Our Delta programming began with a great assist from our sister program in the state of Georgia, Dr. Yolanda Graham. I don't know if she's been on your phone calls before, but in my opinion, she is a rock star. She came to Devereaux, Georgia with the experience of treating youth survivors of exploitation, and in fact had helped form a couple of the first safe houses or safe group homes in the state of Georgia that served this population. So she brought her expertise to Georgia, and they began programming to serve youth survivors of exploitation in their residential treatment program. When Florida came to us and said, hey, could you do this? We leaned heavily on her and her expertise that she already had developed and her relationships with other providers to be able to really get a leg up on what we were doing before we even got started. So she gave us some recommendations, and we went through it, went for it. We named our program the Delta program. I don't know if y'all are familiar with Florida at all, but our Viera campus program is where the space shuttle used to go up, and everything on the Viera campus is named after some sort of space, I don't know, rocket program, whatever that might be. So Delta kind of went in with that space tech, not that space theme, but it also gave us, I really am really like the symbol of the triangle, because what we were trying to do is find something that was going to be the name of our programming without saying it's for sex trafficking, without saying it's for girls, without saying it's those girls or those boys or that population. And we used the triangle to say what we really wanted to do, and they do this in a lot of the promising practices for treating survivors of exploitation, is you want to take somebody from being a victim to a survivor to a leader. And in doing that, we used the triangle to say that we were going to provide treatment and skills at the bottom of the triangle, and our leadership is really that point of the triangle at the top. We developed it as a treatment track, meaning we weren't going to have a specific program. It wasn't a specific unit. It's not a specific wing. And we had the capacity at the time to layer it over already existing programs across our continuum of care. So we initially started at our VR campus. We then went to our specialized therapeutic group services, our foster care programming, and we provide outpatient programming, which is more of a wraparound model, in several counties throughout the state of Florida. We named it Delta, and then for the first girls, one of the first girls groups that we had when they were graduating from that group, we said, you know, we named it Delta. This is why. We gave them a little bit of background, but what does Delta mean to you? And we said, what were words to describe you? And they actually did a group activity and came up with all of these words that they wanted to use to describe themselves, and said Delta was going to represent for them that they were going to be dedicated and determined to be empowered, to become leaders, to triumph over their adversity, and become advocates for themselves and others. So this is my, I have this plastered everywhere because it was such a powerful movement for that first group of girls that they were able to use that to what they would want to describe themselves as. One of the largest questions, and I get a lot, and it's a question across the United States right now, and I know this is a residential behavioral call, but why a continuum, right? Because part of it is there are half of the proponents are saying never locked residential treatment. You're locking them in. They're in chain. They're enslaved. This, that, and the other. And the other half are completely locked them up all the time. They need to be locked in buildings. That's the main form of treatment. We say you really need a continuum because, you know, as we all know, all kids have individual needs, and not all exploited children need residential care, and not all of them can remain safe in outpatient and community-based settings. So it provides that accessibility at whatever point of entry and whatever level of care that they might need. And that's how we have devised this in the state of Florida. What we have done with our continuum of care is we have the same treatment goals. We have the same treatment interventions. We have the same language throughout our continuum. So individuals can move throughout the continuum and expect the same thing, regardless of what setting they're receiving that treatment in. Any questions thus far? Because I can just talk. If y'all know me, I'm talk. But I'm going to go ahead. The goals of our programming across our continuums really focus on individuals regaining a sense of safety, looking at their symptoms related to the very, very complex trauma that they've suffered, to increase some internal insight into their emotions and their behaviors and their actions associated with that trauma and those triggers that they have, increasing their coping skills. We do develop an individualized, it's based on a RAP plan. We call it a success plan, but it's specific to trafficking. And it is, you know, are my triggers, it's risk reduction activities, it's how to deal with, you know, my triggers when I have them in the moment, things that I can do for myself. And we end our relapse prevention plan with a takeaway plan for safety, which is really, risk reduction and safety. Because one of the main issues that we have and have seen with this population is the, incidence of runaway is quite large. Especially if you're not in a locked residential treatment facility, to talk about those safety issues up front with youth, because it's almost expected at some point in time that they're going to be not in your care anymore. So what we want to work for also is a successful discharge to a lower level of care, and to maintain what they're doing in a community setting, which is the optimal, right, for any of the youth that we serve. So what we have seen a lot of with this population, the different wounds that we have treated, we almost, I would say 100% of the youth in our programming, and we've had right now, we've had 99 children in our residential treatment programming. We have discharged, I believe, 87 or 80, I think 80 or maybe 80. Don't quote me on that. I'll have the numbers later. But I almost 100% at least need drug and alcohol education, if not treatment. We have seen a lot of physical, dental, and traumatic brain injuries with this population. A lot of somatic symptoms as well. And we say somatic, but there's a lot of anxiety. But there's also a lot of physical health issues that you're bordering on. Is it for real? Is it not? Sexually transmitted diseases. We deal with a lot of trauma around miscarriages and a lot of trauma around birth as well. We've treated several young mothers who have been separated from their youth because of their trafficking and their experiences, along with the other things that you would really expect with your, you know, trauma symptoms, anxiety, the inability to get to sleep at all with your insomnia. The shame, the self-hatred, the grief, and the fear. We had to do a lot of education with our direct care staff around all of these symptoms. We do a whole training on our campus that has evolved over time, but we do training with every role on campus. And those roles go from the people who, you know, greet you at the front door to the clinicians. But we have done a lot of training on sex exploitation. But we have also done a lot of training on and I just muted everybody because I heard somebody. I'm going to unmute you in a little bit. It's just a little bit easier than doing it singularly. You can unmute yourself, though, if you have a question by going up here to your bar. Okay? But a lot of, also, I think I was talking about shame. Shame is hard to explain, and shame is hard to treat. And the individuals that have been our survivors of exploitation deal with a lot of shame. So we've done a lot of training with our clinicians and our direct care staff over how to work with that in the youth that we treat and in the families that we treat. So a little bit about our programming and the modality services, and then I'll get into the outcomes that we have had. So the youth served, and we're talking specifically right now about our Vieira campus program. Our Vieira campus program is a 136-bed residential treatment center with both locked and unlocked buildings. So you can be in locked and unlocked buildings in this programming. We serve youth with mental health issues as well as youth with intellectual disabilities on this campus. And we have had some crossover youth served in this program that are intellectually delayed as well as trafficked. There's a study out of Florida right now where they did some number crunching for survivors, youth survivors, and youth, I think it was 21 and younger, out of Jacksonville, Miami, and Tampa. And they're sampling through the Department of Juvenile Justice, and they found that over 30% had a co-occurring intellectual disability along with their status as being trafficked. So that's something to think about. The youth served here in this program that we're talking about have a full-scale IQ of 60 or above, or the ability in social adaptive composite score that makes it their ability to participate in the treatment modalities possible. If not, we'll do a modified version of treatment. The ability to benefit from cognitive behaviorally focused treatment, scores that place the youth in need for a specific trauma-focused treatment, and they have to meet the minimum guidelines for needing residential treatment. It's a residential treatment facility, so if you don't meet those minimal guidelines, you don't need to be there. So that's what the youth look like. The treatment modalities that we use most often in this program our trauma-focused CBT. We actually were very fortunate that we were able to participate in a trauma-focused CBT learning collaborative through the CARES Institute up in New Jersey. And we were able to bring them down. Esther Deblinger actually came down and trained at one of our central locations, clinicians from across the state, and we were able to get, I think, 70 clinicians trained in trauma-focused CBT, and we're using that almost primarily or exclusively with a lot of the trauma treatment that we're doing with this program. We also use a lot of motivational interviewing. The ABA services, we're very fortunate. We have a lot of behavior analysts in our programming. We're able to use them as needed in this program, in addition to having a milieu program as well that the youth participate in. We also are fortunate that we have some DBT intensively trained clinicians. I'm a huge believer in DBT. I think if you can teach any adolescent DBT skills, it'll change their life forever. I think if you can teach my youth that have been trafficked some DBT skills, if I can teach her how to dear man to get something in a manner that is effective for her, it's going to change her life. So we do a lot of those skills building. We use CBT. We have some specialized group curriculums that we also use. We use something called the STRIVE curriculum, which is a curriculum that was shared with us and developed out of the state of Georgia. And it is a 20-lesson curriculum specifically for youth that have been trafficked. I say it's a combination of DBT and DBT with a little motivational interviewing thrown in there. There's some psychoeducation components in there as well. That's a huge, huge component to our programming. I can't say enough about that, not only that curriculum, but all of the groups that we offer. We do a psychoeducation group as well with the youth in this program based on trauma. Trauma impact, what fight, flight, and freeze means, how it impacts your body, how your body feels, how it can impact your behavior. And the psychoeducation component, I think, is huge because a lot of the kids come to us really thinking that they are, and I'm quoting somebody that was recently, they were like, I thought I was crazy when I came here. Like, I didn't think, like, my brain was telling me all of these things. And she was able to verbalize, like, I know why now I was doing these things. And so that psychoeducation component is just huge. We also have the ability and provide art group therapy. We also do art individual therapies if the individuals want to participate in them. But that art group is really, really important. We do an expressive writing group with this population. And we also encourage participation in some movement therapies if they're able to participate and want to participate. The treatment interventions, as I said before, we do a lot of therapy, right? We do individual therapy. We do group therapies. The girls in this program are involved at least in, I want to say, 2 to 3 groups a week at any given time, specific to trafficking and trauma, in addition to any other groups that they might participate in campus on. Family therapy is a huge component if there is a family willing and able to participate. And we'll go over who we've served, but that's a huge component, particularly in the family that they're going to be returning to, obviously, to do a lot of psychoeducation with the parents as well. We have found has increased their ability to understand, reduce their guilt, reduce their shame, and really has focused on the healing of the family. Recreational therapy, movement therapy, peer support, case management, and substance abuse services and psychiatric services is what we provide. We also, when we started this program, we were already doing some DBT consultation. We were consultation groups weekly. We were doing team meetings weekly. We were doing all these other meetings weekly. And we thought with these particular programming and this particular treatment track, we want to have some bi-weekly meetings where everyone gets together, kind of like an a la DBT team, but everyone gets around the same table and we talk about what's happening with the track. It has kind of moved away from that, and we've implement a different model, which is a small team model, which is a whole different conversation. But in the beginning, when we first initiated this program, those biweekly meetings were so very helpful because you can learn and you can go and you can start your programming and you're going to have a couple doozies of experiences, right? I do a whole presentation on what I wish I knew before we started doing this, because you're going to try things and go, oh, goodness, that didn't work. You know, I say, I think the title of it's Lessons Learned, or We're Not As Smart As We Thought We Were, because we learned ongoing. We also provide specific supervision to clinicians involved in the treatment. So we have a clinical coordinator who goes to all of our different programming across the continuum and provides specific consultation and review to clinicians treating the population so that they are able to increase their ability to provide the service in the moment to those that they're serving. And then on an operational or administrative level, we get together every 3 months and really look at the treatment track, the outcomes, and what's going well and what's not going well. The assessments and outcomes that I'm talking about, we do. The global assessments that we use are the CBCL, the Child Behavioral Checklist for Children. We also do some youth self-report and the teacher reports as well. The data that we're going to look at is the CBCL, though. For trauma screening, we do the CANS, commercial sexual exploitation version. We just started doing the CANS January of last year, so January of 2016. That is what the state of Florida decided that they wanted to use for tracking outcomes, so we started doing that then. From the beginning, we did the trauma symptom checklist for children. At times, we'll also do the UCLA PTSD index, we have started collecting data on the adverse childhood experiences questionnaire as well upon admission to this program, or upon admission really to any of our programs. The symptom-specific assessments that we use are the SASE for the substance abuse, and we use the Beck inventories. We do the, you know, we have the five booklet or the five scale booklet that we might do at admission, but we tend to do a lot more ongoing of the anxiety and the depression inventories. We also have the ability to refer for psychological testing. Oftentimes, kids are coming to us and they have really struggled in a lot of placements. And that ability to have a really good psychological done can give you a lot of insight on, you know, what's going to work, what might not work, and where somebody is through that sort of testing. We are also collecting post-treatment information, which includes an interviewer survey that we do over the phone that asks questions about returning to the life of exploitation, their living situations, incidents of running away, and their quality of life indicators. Right now, I'm still working on getting that post-service information for the three-year period, and we do it at different intervals. We do it at 3, 6, and 12 months, and I can say we have some okay information at 3 months, but that 6 and 12 months, it's really hard to get that post-outcome information specifically from this population. I am going to unmute everybody for a sec. Does anyone have any questions or? All right, I'm going to mute again. So, what we had as far as our population served, this is over, like I said, the 3 years, age of admission at our residential treatment facility at Viera, Florida. And you can see the majority are the purple, which were age 15. The blue is age 16, age 17, and then we have 14, 13, and then 1% that were under the age of 13. The youngest child that we have treated in this program was 7, and that was familial exploitation, and she did not participate in the true treatment track. Obviously, she was much younger than everybody else. We did a modified version, but she was the youngest that we actually discharged successfully to an adoptive home. So community versus dependent, you served. Dependent, I'm saying that you're in state custody. You're in the foster care system. And we serve from all over the United States in this program. So we have not had any international placements in this program, but we have had numerous states participate and send youth to the program. 31% of the youth served in this program are community youth, meaning that they have no dependency involvement. They are under the care and custody of their parents. Race, 53% are African-American, 24% Caucasian, 12% Hispanic, 7% biracial, and then we have other. Our others are, we have American Indian, Jamaican, Haitian, and there was somebody else that I chose not to identify. Historical characteristics of youth served. What we do is we ask at admission and while we're doing the biopsychosocial, ask youth to report what they have a history of. So in looking at this graph, 97% of the youth in our program endorsed a history of running away, 92% endorsed a history of truancy, 65% endorsed a history of sexual abuse, 50% a history of physical abuse, 82% endorsed prior legal charges, 24% endorsed being active in a gang, and 91% endorsed prior use of substances, with 12% endorsing prior history of pregnancy or live birth. And then we also get some information on the parents, so parental characteristics of our youth serve. And if you look at this graph, we have 49% endorsed at least one parent with a criminal history, 14% endorsed parental arrest for prostitution, 73% endorsed being from a single parent household, and 53% endorsed parental substance abuse, with 85% endorsing some form of child welfare involvement, either they're currently or in their past. If you look at, and I don't know how much training y'all have had on exploitation, but some of the higher risk factors for exploitation are being from a single parent household, having prior history with the Department of Children and Families, prior history of physical abuse. There are some studies that indicate that between 70 and I think 90% have some sort of history of sexual abuse. And the data that we're collecting shows adherence with what those figures have said. When we're talking about outcomes, with the CBCL outcome for the overall competence scales of school and social competence, the test found that there was a significant there is an improvement, but there was no statistically significant difference. If you're looking at the syndrome scales, the test found that there was decreases for many of the scales, but that was a significant decrease in the scores for somatic complaints, rule breaking, and the externalizing problem subscale. But again, when I look at all of them, I go, are they going in the direction that I want them to go? We have my supervisor here, who is our clinical director, is a psychologist who did the numbers for this. And he's like, regardless, if it was statistically significant, they're at least all going in the directions that we want them to go. And the DSM-oriented scales, Again, there was no statistically significant differences, but everything seems to be going in the way that we want it to go. With the trauma symptom checklist, they found a statistically significant decrease for the anxiety, depression, sexual concerns, and sexual preoccupation subscales between admission and discharge, which is huge. When you're looking at the CANS, I don't know if y'all are familiar or not. Some of the scores you want to go down, some of them you want to go up, depending on what they were. But if we're going through the CANS, commercial sexual exploitation, this is the life domain functioning, showed that there was a significant decrease in the scores for social functioning and recreation. And if we're going for the educational domain, there was a significant decrease in the scores for school behavior, school achievement, and school attendance. If we're looking at strengths, there was a significant decrease or improvement, right, in looking at the strengths for optimism, educational strength, resilience, and the resourcefulness domains. And looking at the behavioral and emotional needs, there was a significant decrease in the readings for depression, oppositional defiance, conduct, and the adjustment and trauma at admission and at discharge. So in review of all of those, as I said before, they all were going in the manner or the way that we wanted them to go. We wanted them to either increase or decrease, and they're all going that way. More specifically, there was a significant decrease in two of the three measures of depression that we were measuring, and a significant decrease in most of the measures of externalizing symptoms. And one thing that we really need to adhere to is the continued really effort of collecting all the outcome data for the programming. We collect this for our outpatient and our other programs as well. We just haven't gotten to if y'all have ever done something like this. It's really time intensive to go through and get your outcomes and get all those surveys in and the report written and the analysis. So our next project is doing the surveys for the outcome of this, as well as looking at our other group home placements and our wraparound services. So that is my contact information. If you would like any further information or you wanted some more specific questions that you might have or any information that you might have, this is my contact information. Probably the best way to get hold of me is by email, and that's my email, lpompa@devereaux.org. Or you can reach me on my cell phone. That is area code 386-523-4297. And I am going to unmute everybody to see if anyone has any questions.
Wonderful. Thank you, Lisa. What a great presentation. So, yes, if anyone has questions.
Lisa, this is Steve Girelli from Connecticut. One of the things I was wondering about in looking at the change, the pre-post comparison, were the areas in which there was greatest change, including those that where there was statistically significant change, areas that the program tended to focus on, or are there other factors that you folks think might account for the fact that those in particular showed statistically significant improvement?
Right. We do focus a lot on mood and anxiety because that is almost everyone is presenting with them. So a lot of our individual and group treatment does focus on that. And we have talked about that if we need to focus on other things to make it more systemic improvement across the board. But I think that's absolutely in regards to some of the psychoeducation groups as well as the individual therapy that we do.
Okay. Thank you.
Lisa, this is Jan. I just wondered about your occupancy. Do you have any trouble filling beds? It sounded like you get from across the country.
We do not have any problems filling beds for this population.
Okay. Do you have a waiting list?
You know, it depends on the day. It's just like any other residential specific programming, and that's why we did it as an overlay continuum, so it's not a bed-based program. Mm-hmm. You can be in any of the 136 beds and be in this program.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. But I can tell you that I get calls almost daily looking for treatment for survivors of exploitation.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Lisa? I know there's a little bit of an echo and there's a little bit of background noise, but we're doing our best, so I appreciate everyone's patience. Okay. Well, Lisa, thank you so much. What a beautiful presentation. So well thought out and so well prepared. And we have your contact information. Thank you. Even have your cell phone, which is very kind. So if anybody has any questions, it sounds like you're the person to call.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
Okay. Very good. Well, thanks so much. I think this will actually end our standards call, unless someone has an issue because we are using Lisa's connection today. So let me just ask quickly if anyone has any other business for the NACBH Standards Committee. Okay, everyone is very quiet today. Okay. Pat, anything from you? Okay. All right. Well, then we'll go ahead and wrap up. Our next meeting is July 18th, Tuesday, July 18th at 1 p.m. Same call. Well, it'll be our regular call-in. Not this one, but our regular call-in number for that. So it'll be out in the NACBH News. All right. Well, thanks again, everyone. Really appreciate it. Take care.
Lisa, okay, Lisa, bye. Thank you. This was very, very helpful.
All right. Anytime. Yeah.
Thank you.
Be well.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.